visiting professor from Florida International. He recently got a Hector project to work on software persistent memory, which we're talking about today. He's here for 2 weeks, so if you guys are interested in talking to him after today or after the talk, it doesn't have to be today, but he'll be in CSRI, what number are you in, like 120?
I'm in the lounge.
Away from my office.
Yeah, all the way in the corner.
The corner office down there. He's also got a student, Nate, who's here for the summer, for the whole summer. And Jason, who's another visiting professor, he specializes in discrete event parallel simulation and network simulation. He's going to talk to him today. But I'll let you go ahead and talk about what you got.
Thank you, Ron. Thanks for having me here. And this is a fairly new project that was started just about a year ago, maybe a year and a half. And so it's very much in the initial phases right now. And I'm looking for feedback and also looking for collaboration with you guys. I'll be here for 2 weeks. And I plan to return maybe in a month or month and a half for another 2 weeks. And so I'm hoping that you'll give me some feedback, and also if you're interested in collaborating, I would be very interested in that. So, well, let me start off by acknowledging the people who are involved in this effort so far. This effort has primarily been led by students who work with me. George, Daniel, and Leonardo, they've been doing a lot of development for software persistent memory so far. George actually has been leading the effort. Nate has just started working on it, I guess. And he'll be working on this over the summer with Ron. Colleagues at FIU, Jason, Jinfeng, and Ming, they're faculty there. Jason is right here. And Ron and Sandia. And I'm hoping that there will be more people from Sandia involved in this effort in the future. So let me start with a little bit of motivation for software persistent memory, and I'll abbreviate moving forward as SoftPM. So SoftPM was motivated primarily by a capability called recoverability, and the idea behind recoverability is that HPC applications run for long periods of time, and they need to handle failure in sort of an autonomous fashion. And currently, there are a bunch of solution possibilities. The first is system-level checkpointing, which basically states that the system automatically stores a memory dump or all the in-memory state of the application, and then which can later on be recovered to restart the application. Now, this class of solution is somewhat inflexible if you think of applications where only a portion of their state needs to be persistent for their for them to continue moving forward after a crash. So, and also, it involves a lot more overhead because a lot more data needs to be saved. Well, then people have looked at application level checkpointing, where the application goes about saving state by itself, so the developer needs to be involved in doing the checkpointing of key memory pieces of memory that needs to be recovered later on. So as you can imagine, this increases the burden on the developer. The other issue with application level checkpointing right now is the way application level checkpointing is implemented, all the memory state must be dumped each time a checkpoint needs to be created. For applications where only a portion of the state changes, that might introduce additional overhead. There is also a portability issue. Because the application developer writes the checkpointing code, he perhaps would optimize for a specific storage backend. Let's say a Panasis parallel file system backend, and the way he creates those checkpoints may not be well suited for, let's say, a Lustre backend or even a local SSD backend. So that sort of portability issue does come up, and if you want to move to a different platform, perhaps you have to write checkpointing code afresh. Application-directed checkpointing is the class of solutions where the application provides hints to a library, which then goes about doing the checkpointing. So that addresses portability to some extent, because then you can have the library ported to various storage backends. Current application-directed checkpointing solutions like RVM, which stands for Recoverable Virtual Memory, is sort of outdated. It doesn't work for current systems. And it's also, those class of solutions are a little bit cumbersome because they require the developer to specify the regions of memory that are about to be changed before going about making such changes, so you can get good performance with doing incremental checkpoints. Right? So SoftVM actually lies in the third class of solutions, which is application-directed checkpointing, and I'll describe how we address some of those concerns for those class of solutions. The second motivation for SoftVM is record replay. You can imagine HPC applications that generate large amounts of data, and in several cases, this data cannot be analyzed online. So you have to store the data and then replay or recover the data, perhaps step through simulation timestamps to see what really happened offline or later on once the simulation has concluded. Right? So this is what we call record replay. Of course, you can think of system-level record replay, but this turns out to be inapplicable because the replay is controlled in some sense. So you want the replay to occur at certain time granularity with application semantics. And if you do this at the system level, you do not have that sort of control. So you could, of course, do application-directed record replay, where the application requests a record replay functionality can be implemented over something like an RVM, but doing or refactoring RVM to do record replay turns out to be very cumbersome, given its current design. The third motivation for SoftVM is execution branching, wherein a scientist may want to explore simultaneously multiple paths in the simulation space. So what scientists currently do is to restart the application, change the parameter, right? So you can explore that specific instance of the parameter. And this is, of course, time-consuming because you have to go through multiple runs of the application. What we would like to do is to create a capability where the memory state gets cloned and then the simulation simultaneously proceeds on two instances of the memory state. So this, of course, may not be possible for all applications. There may be applications that require all the physical memory, right? And cloning memory has to be done in a very careful way. So what we envision is something like copy on write. So all the memory that doesn't change between these two instances is stored as a single instance, but then as the branches deviate, only the portions of memory that change would need to be replicated. So you can do this in a more intelligent way to reduce the overhead of cloning. So we started off with these goals: recoverability, record replay, and execution branching. Today, I'm going to be mostly talking about the first capability, which is what we have implemented. Record replay is currently a work in progress. We are still finalizing design details, and there's still a lot more work to be done there. And execution branching is something that we haven't really thought about in any detail at all. So today I'm going to be talking mostly about recoverability. Yes.
So just a motivating comment here. Capabilities two and three, which you're just starting to explore, I believe those would be potentially really interesting in cybersecurity applications, mm-hmm. because record replay and, you know, testing alternative ways of looking at the data and processing data, those are something that, you know, we deal with every day. So keep that in mind going forward that, you know, you've got another market sitting out there that, you know, isn't in the traditional scientific computer space, but it's a big market.
That's true. We haven't thought about security applications of soft PM yet.
Well, the first thing I thought of when I saw their, or when we talked about their original proposal was really for the third one. And it was for simulation. So for optimistic types of solutions for simulation, you could go off and, so typically what you do is you pick the highest probability case and follow that branch. And then if it's not that case, then you have to roll back. So this way, you could actually go to the top two, and you could increase your probability of being correct. Even if you missed the top one, you would still have the state of the second one. You could throw away the one you don't take, and it would allow you to avoid some of the synchronization pitfalls that you have for these big discrete event simulators. So that was the other application I thought of for execution branching.
So execution branching. So it sort of sounds like four.
It is like a fork, but it is sort of like a fork. What we envision, though, is that execution branching would be combined with record replay. So along each branch, you can also record state, and you can recover.
Okay.
And so it's sort of tying in all of these three things together.
Yeah, but
it is, you know, semantics would be something like fork with the copy and write and everything.
So I guess the other thing that comes to mind with execution branching and what you just said, Ron, kind of stimulated this thought. I wonder if some of these V&V type simulations can play into that, where you can do the computation at a certain point and now create a bunch of branches, you know, tweaking parameters and so forth to, you know, assess the reproducibility of the simulation.
There are a bunch of research actually in the simulation doing cloning, precisely for the reason that we don't want to actually start the simulation from the very beginning. We go and make some decision points that's where you branch. Some of the simulation community actually thought about sort of doing simultaneous. They have the different clones to be executed simultaneously, but they're doing this at sort of the user level. There's no system support in doing this, and this is certainly not for the HPC. There are some HPC concerns, but none of those are actually dealing with on our scale on simulation.
Okay. All right, so I'm going to continue now. Okay, so SoftVM provides applications the capability to allocate and interact with persistent memory the way applications would interact with volatile. Okay, so that's what we are going after. So you do your malloc as you would for volatile memory, but now that piece of memory is persistent. And all of that is transparent to the application. There are two notions of persistence that we formalize here. The first is durable persistence, which means data that's in memory should be durable, even after a failure or a power or a crash. And the second notion is immutable persistence, which means memory gets versioned. So it doesn't change. You can go back to a specific version of memory and recreate that instance. We came up with a bunch of deliverables for SoftVM to be practically viable. First of all, the application programmer interface must be simple. It must allow simplicity and recoverability. The persistent memory updates must be atomic, so we are going after transactional semantics. So you make changes, and then the application could decide when persistence points occur. And at those persistence points, memory changes are committed atomically to durable storage. So when you recover memory, it's either the new version or the previous version, but not an intermediate version, which might be inconsistent from the application standpoint. We want to go for simple recoverability and navigation through various versions of persistent containers. So this container terminology is something I'll formalize in a little bit. Also, we would like for persistent state branching. So each of these ties with the, one of those capabilities that we spoke about earlier. To give you a very high-level idea of how this could work, is think about a process P and P's address space, which is composed of a bunch of pages in memory, and there is some sort of persistent storage. It could be either local or remote. A sync operation simply creates an image of the page as is on storage. So immediately you can see that we are eliminating any sort of serialization requirement. So regardless of how complex your data structure would be, there is no overhead. So sort of, rather I should say, it's the same overhead with some caveats, which I'll go into later on, for whether you would have a hybrid data structure composed of a hash table, each element being a tree, each element of the tree being a linked list. So you can have arbitrarily complex data structures, right? But you don't pay the price for serializing such complex data structures. And you can argue that it is, in fact, not possible to create a generic serialization mechanism, right, for an arbitrary hybrid data structure. If it's an array, simple, the linked list, probably simple to serialize it, but for the data structures that are more complex than that, serialization may not even be possible. So we don't do that. On a restore operation, you bring back that same page as is, but now you notice that this page actually got moved in the address space. And that creates a problem when you have pointers to data in that page. Now, when the data gets moved, the pointers need to change so that your memory is consistent. So we deal with that issue in a very explicit way. Okay, so the container is sort of a fundamental concept in SoftPM. Applications create a container and then associate persistent memory with the container. A simple container is one where this was primarily created for the first capability, where there is no really, you know, there is no notion of versioning. So applications can create one or more simple containers of arbitrary size, and what they need to do is very simple to actually make that container persistent and associate memory in their address space with that container. But they specify a root structure, and from the root structure, they create pointers to the data structures that they wish to make persistent and associate with that container. So I'll give you an example in just a bit. What SoftPM does is that it automatically discovers all data that is reachable from that root structure. So now this obviates the requirement for applications to explicitly say that a specific node within a tree is persistent. All the application needs to do is to associate the root of the tree within this root structure and say this, and SoftPM automatically discovers the entire tree and makes that persistent. So our first version was not discovery oriented. Our first version was required applications to explicitly specify each memory allocation to be persistent and associate with a specific container. Okay. So we sort of moved ahead from that and said we want to go for automatic discovery. Now, restoring a container is actually very simple. SoftPM returns the root structure. And from that root structure, the application can explore all the container data. So this, of course, assumes that an application that restores a container knows the semantics of the root structure, right? And knows how to explore the internal structures with starting from the root. So I'll give you an example in a bit. Version containers, each persistent point would create a new version. So you preserve previous versions, and past versions, again, are restorable with a single operation. So when you restore a persistent container now, you also specify a version number. And then you can switch from one version to the next version. So if you created 100 versions and you want to do record replay, you could start from the first version and then skip through versions. You could either go 1, 2, 3, 4, or you could go 1, 5, 10, 15 with a single operation. So what would happen is that those switch operations would immediately change the in-memory contents of the container. And then you would be looking at version 5 instead of version 1. So we want to go for that sort of semantics. Right? We also want to make a version container branchable. So, of course, this part is still work in progress, and branching is something we haven't even explored yet. So, but this is where we want to go. The API, this is our current API, and it's going to evolve over time, I guess. But this has already evolved over a couple of versions. The first is container administration. So the application can create a container and free a container and delete a container. The difference between free and delete is one frees the in-memory version of the container, the other one deletes it from persistent storage. But there are some management API here, which I won't go into, but the ones that are important are creating a persistence point and creating a persistence point synchronously. So the application can create persistence points asynchronously. And SoftPM will, in the background, write out that persistence point, while the application can continue to do what it needs to do. So that reduces the blocking. But as you can imagine, the application can go ahead and change memory as it executes. So those modifications are actually trapped, and then a copy and write instance of pages are created so that a consistent version of that persistence point is written out to storage, even while application executes, allowing the application to change those pages. Restoring and navigating through branches is fairly straightforward. You could restore a container which returns a root structure. You could switch through versions, and you could create a clone of a container to create a new branch. So that's our current API. Now let me walk you through an example. And this is a recoverability example. And this is C code, of course, and you might all be familiar with what's going on here. It's very simple, actually. We are creating a linked list, right? And, sorry about that. This is without any persistence. So you allocate memory, you create the pointers, you chain them all together, right? And so there you have your linked list. Now imagine that you want to make this linked list persistent. What would you need to do with SockPM? Well, first of all, you need to create a root structure, which is all the way up there, and then create a pointer to your linked list within that root structure. Well, ignore this for the time being. The next thing that you need to do is to allocate a container and associate an instance of that root structure with that container. Return to your container ID, and then you go about creating your linked list as you would. The only additional step that needs to be done is to set up a pointer from that linked list to the first element, first node of the linked list. So that linked list becomes reachable from the root structure. Similarly, if you were to create a hash table and you wanted to make that persistent, you create a pointer from that root structure to the hash table. And that's all that needs to be done. The rest of the code remains exactly as it were before, right, go about creating the linked list, and at some point, you would like to make this linked list persistent. So you create a persistence point. Now what was happening was that all the process memory is being managed by SOC-PM. So it keeps track of all allocations, it keeps track of pointers. I'll talk a little bit more about how we deal with pointers later on, but assume that this happens in the background. There's a list of pointers here, right? And all the nodes are within memory that SOC-PM manages. These get written out, including the page that stores the pointers.
Is SOC-PM providing its own version of malloc, or is it just swapping the pointers?
Well, all mallocs are interposed upon. So SOC-PM is sort of a virtualization layer built on top of malloc. So internally, to allocate memory for the process, SOC-PM uses malloc. But then it provides its own version of malloc to the application. So in that interposition layer, it does all of this stuff.
So these calls to malloc in this listing, in this second listing, are invoking different code than in the first listing.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for pointing that out. I missed that. Yeah. Okay. Restoring is actually very simple. You pass an instance of the container root structure, and the restore just returns a valid container root structure. And from that point onward, the application can go and access its linked list. But a whole bunch of things need to happen in the background, right? Well, first of all, each of those pages that were written out needs to be loaded back into memory. Now notice that P1 got loaded into PI, which is a different address for the same page. Which means that all the pointers to locations inside PI get invalidated, right, or the original P1. So SOC-PM maintains a list of previous and current addresses of various pages. So as it loads pages, it creates that table. In one of those pages, it has a list of pointers. So it walks through that pointer list and goes about fixing each of those pointers, so now they become valid again. So there, a flexibility with SOC-PM is that as long as you have some space in the process address space, you can bring in those pages wherever you want, free to move those around, which was one of the biggest restrictions with RVM. And modern systems actually require this flexibility for doing security. Okay, so address space randomization, there are heap-based attacks that you can avoid if you have this flexibility instead of having to restore to the same portion of the address space. So this sort of makes SOC-PM more relevant for today's needs. Okay. So I'll walk you through the architecture really quickly now. The API is supported by two components internally. One is LIMA, which stands for Location Independent Memory Allocator, and there are a whole bunch of things that that need to happen with memory management. And then there is a software I/O driver, which primarily optimizes I/O and provides the transactional semantics. So when you write out persistence points, the software I/O driver is the one that ensures that either the persistence point is completely available in durable storage or not at all. And you can build modules for various backends. So you can have a Lustre backend, you can have a Panacea backend. All these can be changed to best suit the capabilities of the backend. Okay. So let me tell you a little bit more about how data gets mapped from containers to the process virtual address space and from containers to the storage backend. the memory management layer actually creates the abstraction of a virtual volume within which you can have multiple containers. So each application and even multiple applications can create containers within the Lima virtual volume. Now this container virtual address space is on the memory that becomes persistent. The volatile portions of memory do not appear in the container virtual address space. There is a container page table, which is different than the system page table, that maps container address spaces to process virtual address spaces. And if you're wondering where the system page table is, the system page table would map the process virtual address space to physical memory. Right? So that's another level of interaction which is not relevant to SOC-VM. The container virtual address space is managed in chunks, which are multiple pages. So they are fixed size units, but they consist of multiple pages. Now, of course, the size of the container is something that needs to be tuned. The size of the chunk. Now, this chunks from the container virtual address spaces get mapped to physical storage by this chunk indirection map. Now, this chunk indirection map must also be persistent. So when you restore chunks, you need to restore the right chunk. But this indirection map allows complete flexibility in writing any chunk to any of these chunk slots in storage. So that allows for some interesting I/O optimizations. So this sort of a central picture, and if you have questions, I'll be happy to answer.
So when you malloc some new memory, does it come out of one of the containers, or is it just end up being linked into by one of the containers? In other words, is a container just a starting address for a search of all linked memory, or is a container like a heap?
Well, the container is a subset of the heap, right? So all the dynamically allocated memory is split into two parts. One is persistent, the other is volatile. The persistent portions of the heap would be mapped to one of these containers. So the application can create more than one container and say, okay, this is my container for my climate matrix, or then there's some other container that stores a different set of data structures which are not related perhaps as much to the data in the first container. So the applications do have that flexibility.
What if they are related? How do you get a consistent snapshot if
they're all related, you probably want to put them all in one container. And you create pointers from the root structure to each of the data structures that are all related.
So what if, I mean, if you have an application of the same logic containers, I know that each container has its own policy in terms of how persistence is actually carried out, periodic or occupant. What if that somehow these two, their data structure somehow got mixed together, and when you try to go through one container, go through the pointers and somehow find a page which is actually belonging to the other container, is this going to be the error?
Right now it's an error. We don't deal with that. But that's something we need to think more about. There are a whole bunch of issues that we haven't thought about yet, right? And that's why I said right up front that this is sort of very much in the initial phase. We've done some work, but there's a lot more to do, and I'm hoping that, you know, we can collaborate on some of these things. Okay, any other questions about this? All right. So what are the challenges for the memory management? First, the containers need to be completely self-describing, which means any metadata associated with container virtual address spaces should also be embedded in the container virtual address space, right? So the container virtual address space is not just persistent data, it's also metadata to manage that persistent data, right? So when you store a container, not just, let me go back here for a second. This is the data that the application allocate gets written to storage, but also the container page table, because that's metadata that describes the data. The second challenge is automatic container discovery. How do you automatically figure out what data to make persistent for each container? Automatic change detection and updating. So, as I said before, writing out the entire container at each persistence point may not be necessary. In fact, probably excessive, so we only want to write the changes. Container versioning and branching support, that's something I'm not going to talk about much. The container page table actually looks very much like a regular system page table. It's multi-level, right? So there is an outer page directory. And the reason for why we have multi-level page tables is because we would like to address a larger container virtual address space. And then each of these inner levels contain pointers, where eventually you would have pointers to container page table entries. Each of those container page table entries contain an allocation unit. So SOCVM manages memory using a slab allocator. So each time it allocates a page from the system, it associates an allocation unit, let's say 50 byte allocation units or 100 byte allocation unit or 10 byte allocation units. This is to simplify or speed up memory allocation performance. And then of course you need a bitmap to tell you which ones are available and which ones are not in this lab. The root structure is the first address in the container virtual address space. So you know the root structure is available in a fixed location, and you return that pointer to that first page to simplify the restore operation. The list of pointers also is in a known location. So this is to simplify the management for SOCVM, right? So when a container gets restored, it knows where the root is, it knows where the pointer list is, and then the rest of the data, including these pages which contain the page table meta information, are in the rest of the container virtual address. So this is how the container page table is managed. There are four different components. The first is container manager, which takes care of container allocation. It initializes container metadata, creates a page table, and then creates a pointer list, which gets populated over time as the application executes. Restoration would load back the container data, fix the pointers, and then return the container root structure. So there are lots of things that happen to make all of this possible, and I'll be happy to talk to you about the details offline. Container discovery, there is one design parameter for discovery, which is the time of discovery. When do you discover? Discovery takes CPU. So if you were to discover, which is what we do right now, discover during checkpoint creation time or persistence point creation time, you need to spend a bunch of time first to discover the container and then write it out. So we could play with that. We could do discovery in an online fashion. Discovery requires recursively following pointers starting from the container root to create a transitive closure starting from the container root structure. Now, to do that, we use a tool, which is a static analysis tool that Leonardo and Daniel built for automatic memory allocation and pointer detection. So, and right now, this tool works for C and partially for C++. It breaks for C++ in some cases, but that's something which we are working on. The second thing that needs to be done is reorganization. Now, because SOC-PM actually manages all memory allocations. You have pages that contain both persistent allocations as well as volatile allocations. So once you do the discovery, you know where your persistent allocations are and your volatile allocations. Now we want to separate these two out. So what we do is a memory reorganization step, which is a post-discovery step, where we move data from pages depending on whether that page is marked as persistent or volatile. It's marked as persistent if most of the data in a page are persistent. And then there are some data which are volatile, they need to be moved elsewhere. So that's how we ensure that pages either contain all persistent data or all volatile data after the memory reorganization step.
Is that necessary for it to work correctly, or is it just to optimize?
It is for optimization. It is primarily for optimization.
Yeah.
And like I said before, if you move data, you need to worry about pointers, so you need to fix back references. And that's possible because we know the location of all pointers in the address space. So if you move data, we see where pointers that point to that data and fix those accordingly. The write handler and flusher are two components that are I/O-facing components. The write handler actually monitors writes at the chunk granularity. Okay, this is just for optimization, and you can also change, play with the granularity of the chunk. But this leads to one page fault per chunk between two persistence points. Right? Because once a chunk is written to, we allow all future writes to go through without a fault. So we just need to mark that chunk as dirty so that it gets written out in the next persistence point. The write handler also does some, it needs to do something special to deal with asynchronous persistence points. And I don't have time to go into that given the constraints, but I'll talk to you offline if you're interested. The flusher is the component of Lima that actually writes out to the I/O component. And the flusher can be configured for each container. You can specify whether persistence is on demand. On demand means that the application requests persistence explicitly. Could be periodic or it could be continuous, which means that all changes must be made persistent. Each change must be made persistent. So we actually expect the on demand policy to be the most relevant or relevant to most applications. Well, the flusher task is actually fairly straightforward. It registers a persistence point creation event with the software I/O driver component, and then it writes out all the dirty chunks asynchronously and finally registers an end point for the persistence. So that's the memory management related component. And the storage component has some challenges. First, of course, is performance.
Before you move on. So,
yes.
So the flusher also has, doesn't it also have to sort of tag that data structure as this is the version we're going to flush? Because if you're doing it asynchronously, then you can, you have this copy on write protocol for any modifications to the data structure, right?
Exactly. So the write handler actually deals with that, and it needs to deal with the writes that occur because the checkpointing is asynchronous.
Okay.
So the second challenge is atomicity. So we want to go for transactional semantics for all persistence and of course, scalability. So going back to this figure, the persistent chunk indirection map actually helps with the performance. The key ideas, I won't go into the individual components as said, but just give you some a list of key ideas. Well, first of all, we know that disk and SSD-based storage are optimized for sequential, large sequential writes. Okay, so we want to do large sequential writes instead of small random writes. And managing memory in chunk or multi-page granularity actually helps with this. Chunk remapping is actually very, very powerful. If you want to do any transactional semantics for in-memory data, you could either do it in a log-structured fashion, or you could do it in a journaling style, with journaling style writing, where you write first to a journal area and then checkpoint it out to the permanent area. But with chunk indirection, you could write out all these chunks as long as you don't replace the original version of the chunk before you do the final commit. And then you write out a final commit chunk. And then that ensures atomicity in a very straightforward way. So I think chunk indirection is something that that can be used for multiple purposes, for atomicity as well as performance. And there are some ways to ensure consistency with the least possible chunk metadata overhead. So we use asynchronous I/O. So all the chunks in a persistence point are written out asynchronously, except for the last chunk, before which there is a flush operation, ensuring that the previous chunks are all written out, and then before writing the final chunk. There are some additional optimizations that we've been thinking about, not yet implemented, to deal with parallel file systems and how those storage backends perform I/O operations. Okay, so I have about 10 minutes, and I wanted to show you some numbers that we have from our implementation. What we did was we compared SOC-PM with application-level persistence, where the application explicitly writes out data structures, but serializes them, and writes it to a file. SOC-PM uses either an SSD directly as a block device, or in one of those experiments actually used the disk drive as well. Now, we evaluated development complexity by measuring lines of code to implement persistence for various basic data structure types, such as a linked list, hash table, arrays, and so on, and trees. Then we did performance evaluation using micro benchmarks that would create one or more containers. Within each container, it would populate that container with one specific type of data structure. So in some sense, we can think of this as a conservative evaluation, because there are no hybrid structures, and there is always a single data structure type. So if there is a linked list, there is not a tree beside it, right? So we wanted to go with a conservative evaluation. Container size is something we varied. When updates needed to be made to data structures, we performed random updates, but then we also varied the update locality. Based on the locality, portions of the address space get modified, and that affects how much data gets written out. Now, this is the development complexity evaluation. We worked with a bunch of data structures, strings, which are just byte arrays, n-dimensional arrays, linked lists, hash tables, and binary trees. So the first column here is the lines of code without any persistence, neither application-level persistence or SOC-PM. And then if you were to add application-level persistence, you would have to additionally include so many lines of code to serialize the data structure and write it out to the file. Then P and R here means persist and restore. So when you persist a data structure, serialization operation, writing operation, when you restore it, there is a reading operation and a deserialization operation. With SOC-PM, these were the lines of code that needed to be added for persist and restore. Right? So it's fairly straightforward. Performance-wise, on the y-axis, what you see is normalized relative time relative to ALP implementation. So this is a two-part graph. On the left side, you see the time, the normalized relative times for SOC-PM relative to application-level persistence. So one means that there is no difference, right? And the lower means that SOC-PM is better, higher means that SOC-PM is worse. For different sizes of the container, which means different sizes of the data structure, for the persist operation, depending on the type of data structure, you have different gains. So immediately what you'll notice is that for the string and array type data structures, there's really no major difference. And I should also point out that the persist operation actually writes out the entire container. So this is the first time for persistence, if you can think of it that way. It's not incremental. If it were incremental, the numbers would probably be different. So you can see immediately there is really no gain for strings and arrays because the serialization is highly efficient. And writing to the file is also highly efficient. So you don't really gain much performance because of SOPN. But for other data structures, you can see that the gains do exist, right? And in some cases, you have, you know, an order of magnitude improvement in performance. And that one is for a B-tree, binary tree. RISTOR is actually a different story altogether, right? In fact, in all the cases, well, except for this guy over here, RISTOR with SOPM is worse than if you were to restore from a file using application-level persistence. The primary reason for this degradation in performance during RISTOR is, I'll tell you later on the numbers, was the time required to fix pointers. So currently our pointer fixing code is highly unoptimized. So we do it in a very brute force way. And most of the time actually is spent in fixing pointers. The other thing which I should point out is that for recoverability applications, most of the time you're doing persists. You're not doing restores. So you'll do a restore only when the system crashes. So for the common case operation, you can see that SOPM actually helps a lot. And this is actually, if you can think about it, sort of the worst case performance because the entire container is written up. If you were to do incremental persistence, the gains would be higher.
The performance gain for, say, B-tree or hash table is because of the I.O. If you were to rearrange the I.O.
Yeah, that's in the next figure. I'll show you. Okay, so we sort of looked at it in a more fine-grained way to look at how much each of those operations contribute. How much does serialization for the file-based implementation or deserialization consume relative to the writing or reading cost? In case of SOPM, we have discovery and pointer fixing operations, and those create overhead. I don't want to look at all of these. Perhaps I'll look at just one of them. Let's look at the B-tree, for instance. The first two are for persist, and the latter two are for restore. The first guy here is for application-level persistence. You can see that all the time is spent in serializing the data structure, the B-tree data structure, it's complex data structure. And very little time actually is spent in writing. So it's very difficult to make out the difference. There is a sort of red dotted line.
Yeah, by reading it wrong to me, it looks like about half and half on the B-tree for the leftmost.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah, I never noticed that before. Yeah, so it's, yeah, actually, this guy stops right here. Yeah, so it's, yeah, you're right, half-half. Yeah. Thanks for pointing that out. I thought it went all the way up. And then for SOPM, well, this part is writing, and this part is discovery, a really small component. And then the relative gains, of course, are, you know, 60% performance improvement. For the B-tree. And that's with a specific size of data structure. In the previous graph we looked at, I think this one is for, I guess, 10 to the 6 with the B-tree, where you get something around 60%, something like that. Or maybe it was for a different size. For the restore operation, you can see that a lot of time is actually spent in pointer fixing operations. So that's a bulk of the overhead. And then there is a reading overhead also, which is higher than when you would read a B-tree, because there's a bunch of metadata that you need to read in. There's a lot of pointers that also need to be read in along with the actual data.
So I'm still a little bit struggling with the B-tree performance. So
if you spend half and half, then understandable that half of the time you, without the PM, you theorize, and then everything's ready, you just write it out, so it takes another 50% of the time. So if you use soft PM, the discovery takes some time, but the writing is actually also saving. You know, if you just look at the absolutes, you know,
that's true.
It makes you faster.
Yeah.
And certainly why.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, I need to think about that. So far, I was thinking all of this was serialization, but now I think it's half-half, and that creates a discrepancy.
Weren't you writing directly to the device, and you weren't using the file system?
That's true, yeah. I mean, there is some benefit from writing directly to the device. We haven't really quantified it. We need to sort of do more fine-grained analysis of our numbers. We haven't done that yet. Okay. Couple of other charts here. Again, normalized relative time as you change the locality of the modifications, and this is for incremental persistence. So as the locality increases, the relative performance of soft PM actually improves. And this is with different chunk sizes. There is sort of a sweet spot at, I think, 64 kilobytes. So if you reduce chunk size below 64 kilobytes, the amount of metadata that you need to manage for those chunks improves. It increases. And that adds the additional overhead, and then you actually degrade performance below 64 kilobyte chunks. This other chart is as you vary the number of threads, and you can also think of this number of containers that get written out simultaneously. So as you increase the number of containers with the chunk indirection, you have the ability to sort of sequentialize writes from a whole bunch of different containers rather than just a single container. If you were to use a single application that does its own serialization, if it were optimizing for I/O, there would be sort of this interleaving of I/O from multiple applications on the same parallel file system, and you would have to pay the penalty for that. With soft PM, you can actually optimize multiple containers, and the speed up relative to application level persistence improves as you increase the parallel system. And then we did something with disk drives. Disk drives actually gave us more stable trends than the SSD. We really don't know why. Okay, some caveats.
Can I ask a question on your evaluation numbers before you move on?
Sure.
Do you have any numbers on the amount of memory overhead, like the total amount of memory taken for the application using versus not using?
We don't. I think if I would be guessing, my guess would be less than 1%.
Okay, so it's just a little bit of extra bookkeeping overhead, mm-hmm. but not doesn't really change how blocks are mapped.
Well, that could change so that you could have, if for some reason the I/O took a long time, and you were modifying that buffer, you could have a worst case scenario where you're doubling, right?
Right. Yeah, that's a different kind of memory overhead, which is because you allow asynchronous modifications, you had to create copies, and those copy and write data.
You're talking about the memory management, the
metadata
of managing the data structures.
Yeah, like is your allocator doing things in a different way that you know makes it more sparse in memory or something, or anything that would severely impact the amount of memory allocated for an application?
Yeah, that's just my guess. My guess is it would be less than 1%, but that's a good question, and we should investigate that. Okay, so some caveats that I listed here. First of all, soft PM is, at least for the performance angle, is not really relevant all that much if you're looking at unstructured data, for instance, strings, because these are easy to serialize. Even arrays, multidimensional arrays, are easy to serialize. You don't gain much from a performance standpoint. But the other thing is that unstructured data also do not typically get modified in place. So you might not gain as much with incremental persistence. Right? So if you think of video or audio, except for very specific use cases, you're doing video editing, they don't really get modified in place. Right? So also, Ron pointed this out, if you had data structures...
Aren't there ways unstructured by this classification? Like,
arrays,
you know, some big Fortran program is just manipulating a bunch of arrays.
True. Yeah, I guess you could call those unstructured as well. And we did notice that with arrays, you don't gain much performance either.
Okay.
So there's really no benefit, or not a whole lot of benefit. You can have a little bit of performance degradation even when you are working with arrays or unstructured data. Or if you have subsets of data structures that must be serialized. In Ron's example, he made he had an array, but only a portion of the array actually needs to be persistent. And SoftPM is not really good for that, because we don't have a way to say, okay, this portion of this data structure needs to be persistent. It's either all persistent or none of it is persistent. But that's something that we could work on, see how we can extend.
The example I thought of was, if you have a finite difference code, typically store your yield cell in the same array as you're actually computing, but you don't really want to store the yield cell. You don't want that to be persistent. So it'd be hard to tell SoftPM that you want index 2 through n minus 2.
Yeah, so those are some instances where SoftPM should probably not be used, or at least not for the performance. Okay, there are some unresolved issues, such as restrictions on the container size. The containers can only be as big as the process virtual address space. But we thought that was okay initially because we are primarily building a persistent memory abstraction. So if you cannot fit your data in memory, and the SoftPM cannot deal with that, and that would be okay. But I mean, we can also think of SoftPM, later on I'll talk a little bit more about this, to build file systems, for instance, to store file system metadata, because file system metadata also need persistence, and they need atomicity of modification, they need transactional semantics, or we could use SoftPM. But then those sort of data structures or persistent metadata do not have any size restrictions. They could be as large as your disk. Right? So can we use SoftPM and do things like demand loading of chunks and then eviction of chunks when they are no longer needed, just like a virtual memory system? There is a problem right now. We cannot really do memory exclusion. Container discovery just goes and grabs everything that's reachable. I cannot say, well, this arm of my tree should not be persistent. Right? But that's something that could potentially be addressed. We haven't really done any work in that direction. There's also an unresolved issue with container sharing semantics. If you have multiple processes sharing a container and they're both reading and writing from it, we haven't really given much thought as to what the semantics should be. And are there any basic rules of thumb that we could go after for defining and describing such semantics? And if you have some ideas about that, I'll be be happy to hear about them.
So the memory exclusion piece might solve the question that Jason asked earlier. But if you have two containers that have cross pointers, then you'd have to exclude. You have to identify that pointer as excluded from this container.
Yeah, that's certainly true. It's something we should be thinking about more. So to summarize, I did talk about all of this stuff. With SoftPM, we want to create a simple abstraction that delivers fully automated persistence, right? Delivers transactional persistence, delivers high-performance persistence. Versioning and branching as well, but this is something that we haven't done a whole lot of work with. And there are applications beyond HPC. I just talked about, how about using SoftPM to store file system metadata? Right? And that simplifies file system metadata management drastically. So I no longer need to worry about where I put my free space bitmap on the disk, right? When you're implementing a new file system. You just restore the container, you know your free space bitmap is available in memory, right? And that's all you really care about. You could also think of building databases for the software, or at least for the metadata portions of the database. There is a whole bunch of self-managing storage system extensions that require persistence of metadata. And SoftPM, actually, the the initial motivation for SoftPM came because of these guys. Where the, all the self-managing storage extensions we were building in our lab. We were writing custom persistence routines for all the metadata and this really quickly got out of hand. And we said that we wanted something like this that would simplify all of that. So some future directions. The near-term directions, things like demand loading chunks, working on container sharing semantics. Well, we are working right now with porting SoftPM to Compute Node Linux, and we really don't know if SoftPM plays nicely with these lightweight kernels. And that's one of the things we want to do over the summer. Right? Use SoftPM for real-world applications. Specifically, right now we are working on getting SoftPM support for Prime, which is a network simulator that, that Jason built. And that's also something we want to do over this summer. We want to do more large-scale experiments, and now we have the infrastructure to do such large-scale experiments, and that's something we are very interested in. Longer-term directions, record replay and execution branching, of course. Programming language portability issues. So we have SoftPM for C, and C++ mostly, right? But how about Fortran? What kind of API can we define? Can we? I know that a lot of the HPC code is written in Fortran, and maybe there's some other language that you write your code in. So please let me know about that. There's also this other issue that was brought up by HPC folks early on, which is, well, our containers are unreadable. So if you look at the disk version of a container, it doesn't make any sense, right? And a lot of these persistent memory formats like HDF5 and FCDF, they are actually, you can read them, right? But with SoftPM, you can build container readers. All you need is the definition of the root structure and the internal structures that this root structure points to, and you can write readers that will give you data. But it has to be software. It cannot be a human reading those containers. Right? So that's something we want to look at in the future. Well, thank you. And I'll be happy to take questions.
Thanks. So I have a comment on your...
this guy?
Yeah. So when you deal with Fortran, for example, program language that a lot of HPC applications actually build on, and reflect back with the comments you give that the unstructured code seems to be, you know, the SoftPM is not really really shy or compared to the others. It's probably, you're referring to the automatic pointer discovery, right? So that if it's unstructured, you can't really do anything in terms of putting things automatically into a closure, right?
But I guess my point is that if you have unstructured data, they are very easy to serialize. So there is really no benefit that you get in terms of performance because SoftPM automates and optimizes such serialization for you, or rather eliminates serialization altogether.
I sort of semi-disagree with that. On the SoftPM side, it's because the SoftPM provides you with other capabilities, right? So if you look at SoftPM, it's not just about automatic serialization, it's about other things.
Transactional persistence.
Right, yes. I don't want to deal with I/O, for example, if I develop my large scale simulator, right?
Sure.
So I want to use that so that you take care of all the I/O issues, right? And I think just to say that's not for that, I guess.
Yeah. Well, being an engineer, I always pick on the drawbacks first. Yeah. Any other comments or questions? I'll be here for 2 weeks, so if you want to chat, or if you have some ideas that you think could use collaboration,
just maybe you should find a language that uses pointers and use that. Maybe
pointer
language that has pointers.
So
pointers in the covers.
Well, and you don't have great with pointers. The data structures that don't need pointers that are easy to serialize.
True.
Fortran, it seems like it would be pretty easy to have a Fortran version. The other thing it does is that,
Well, it does the incremental.
I'm guessing you can trim. Yeah, it's probably pretty hard to detect pointers with 100% accuracy.
With C?
With C,
okay. I have a... Actually, it's not in one of my backup slides, but I think... Let's see. I have the data somewhere. Oh, there you go. So our static analysis stuff.
How do you do that?
Right. Yeah. You arbitrary memory cell could be a pointer.
Right.
You know, that's obviously not going to detect well.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Detect by usage, maybe.
But. Yeah. So here are some numbers for our static analysis tool. So, well, first of all, there is overhead associated with static analysis. And what we use is SIL, which is C intermediate language. It's a static analysis tool that we use to do our pointer detection and memory allocation detection, static code insertion. And then they get registered at runtime, of course. So there is, of course, overhead related to no SIL, and with SIL and no pointer detection or no memory allocation detection, we make this level bigger.
That's the compile time. Right?
That's compile time, yeah. So, yeah.
So
we ran our static analysis tool with a whole bunch of different code bases. We looked at the Linux file system subsystem, right? Linux kernel file system. And then we ran it through the C torture test, which is something worthwhile to talk about, I guess. And then we looked at the implementations of various persistent string, B-tree, and n-dimensional array structures. And these are the various lines of code for all of these code bases. Right? And so here, the what? These are all the instances of the specific type. For instance, 356 out of 356 struct definitions in the Linux file system code base trigger our code transformation routines. And for the number of globals. So if you see structs, all of our structs actually require transformation. Because for each struct, we need to insert a function that tells us for this struct, there are pointers in these offsets. So all of the structs actually trigger transformation, right? The number of globals that are pointers, right? The number of local variables that are pointers that also trigger transformation or memory allocation requests. So it could be either a pointer being detected or a memory allocation request being detected. And these are for fairly large code bases. And then the number of typecasting operations, which are the most tricky to deal with when you're dealing with pointers. Because if you were to allocate some arbitrary void star and put your favorite structure in there, at runtime, you do not know whether what piece of data or the definition of the data inside that void star allocation. The only point that you could actually make that determination is when there is a casting operation before you can use that data. And at that point, we detect pointers inside that data structure. So there's a whole bunch of instances where casting operators led to pointer detection. We thought about that quite a bit, and I think we handle pointer arithmetic because of all of these. But certainly, I mean, getting certainty about the accuracy of pointer detection is not feasible. Right, because you don't know, so with SIL, what you do get is for each possible statement, you get a trigger. So you know for all possible statements that could lead to pointer detection, we inserted code, but there might be some very obscure cases that we haven't handled yet.
Yeah.
But we think that it could be handled. If we know that an obscure case exists, I think we can handle it.
So the other problem that came up in the meeting the other day that you didn't bring up is the caveat was debugging.
Debugging,
which can be a nightmare. We basically have a translation from C to some other version of C that is unreadable.
Is there a possibility? You're doing this in the compile time.
Yes.
Compile time, right? So can you do this actually at the executable level?
Runtime?
Not runtime. Before runtime. You have the executable.
It's very hard. You need type information. That's the key. I mean, you need to know where your pointers are. You need to know where your structs are and how the definition of those structs, what are the members of each struct, whether any of those are pointers. And it's hard to do it at execution time. Any other questions?
Thanks.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.